Okay, well, first of all, I would like to welcome you all on behalf of the organizers, David Morrison, Sergei Gukov, who's coming shortly, I hope, and myself, to this workshop, Langlands Type Dualities in Quantum Field Theory. This is actually the third installment of a series which we have been running here at KITP, of workshops on the general topic of dualities in quantum field theory and the Langlands program. The first one was 2 years ago in July, August, and the second one was last year in March. And we are very happy that and grateful to KITP for its continued support and for letting us hold this third installment, third workshop now here at KITP. These workshops are funded by DARPA through a grant which is administered by me at UC Berkeley. So a lot of things have happened in in the time between the previous workshop and the series and this one, and we hope that we'll have a chance to discuss all these new developments. So in this talk, I would like to just give a very brief overview of sort of the origins of this connection between Langlands program and physics, and perhaps give a preview of some of the lectures that are coming up later this week and next week. So the Langlands program was originally formulated by Langlands in the late 60s, with the goal of connecting some very deep and complicated questions in number theory to more easily discernible questions in harmonic analysis, more specifically in representation theory, in the theory of automorphic representations. So late 60s, and one of the interesting aspects of the Langlands program was the fact that if you study Galois representations and try to relate them to automorphic representations, there is a certain switch that's going on. If you have on one side a certain Lie group G, then on the other side a different Lie group shows up, what is now called the Langlands dual group. So this is sort of a very interesting phenomenon, which immediately tells you that this cannot possibly be a trivial correspondence, a trivial connection. Now, as we all know, in the late 70s, this dual group was rediscovered by physicists in a totally different context, namely in the study of four-dimensional Young-Mills theory, or as we now interpret it, in the study of supersymmetric, N equal 4 supersymmetric four-dimensional Young-Mills theory. So So that's the first connection. So the Langlands program and four-dimensional super young. And this question remained a mystery for a long time. But in the meantime, the Langlands program developed further and went from the original context of number theory and harmonic analysis to geometry. And this reformulation, called the geometric Langlands program or geometric Langlands correspondence, was in the late 80s and early 90s linked to what seems to be a totally different kind of physics, namely two-dimensional conformal field theories. So the Langlands program expands to geometry, and this geometric flavor of the Langlands program is linked to two-dimensional conformal field theories, more specifically in the work of Bellinson and Drinfeld from the early 90s, which linked the geometric Langlands correspondence to the so-called Hitchin system, and then also to sort of conformal field theories with affine Katz-Moody symmetry. So So this actually, this connection actually historically came first, or understanding of this connection historically came first, and then later, about 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, Kapustin and Witten, in a groundbreaking joint work, linked the Langlands program and to the study of S-duality in four-dimensional Super-Young-Mills theory. And so then this connection also sort of materialized in this way, which of course then begged the question as to what is the link. Here these two, if you have this connection, you have this connection, you must have something here. And this has been sort of a mystery for a while, and in the last, what, couple of year or so, a little over a year, there has been some really interesting developments in this area, which now make us believe that we are very close to sort of completing this triangle. And one of the topics that we would like to discuss here at this workshop is this link, this new work connecting four-dimensional physics, four-dimensional quantum field theory, and two-dimensional conformal field theory. Here I'm talking about, more specifically, about the so-called AGT conjecture, Aldai, Gayota, and Tachikawa, which relates partition functions in supersymmetric Young-Mills and conformal blocks in two-dimensional conformal field theory, such as Liouville theory and so on. So we'll have lectures on this topic, sort of both introductory and more technical lectures this week and next week. And in fact, today in the afternoon, Sergei Gukov, which we hope will arrive by then, will give us a preview, a sort of a general overview of this connection. But I think that this is sort of one of the topics which distinguishes this particular workshop from the previous workshops, in that actually we now know a lot more about this link, which hopefully will actually shed more light on this whole picture. Okay, so what I would like to do now is to talk a little bit about this connection. Well, talk first of all about the Langlands program, then about this connection, and then a little bit about this connection. And then Sergei will take over in the afternoon, and he will start the discussion, which will then expand further in the follow-up talks of the connection between four-dimensional and two-dimensional physics. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the Langlands program. And now I will sort of jump ahead and start with the geometric formulation, and more specifically, even not geometric, but what can be called more properly is a categorical formulation. Categorical. I'll call it categorical Langlands correspondence. So the categorical, to explain this, we need to fix some data, so that let C be a complex smooth projective curve over C. Curve over C, or if you will, a compact Riemann surface. Usually I denote it by X, but since we are in a physics institute, I should denote it by C. I think this is a more traditional notation. Well, sigma, but sigma will be used for something else. So that next after sigma in physics alphabet comes C somehow, not X. So I'll use C. So if you see X in the course of this talk, this will be the remnants of my sort of mathematical vocabulary. And so then just replace it by C. Smooth projective curve. And then G will be a reductive Lie group. Also over C, and I will denote by GC later on. GC will be the compact form. Okay, so then we have two moduli spaces, or more properly, moduli stacks. Bund G is a moduli stack of G bundles on C. Principal G bundles on C. And then there is a log G is the moduli stack of flat L G bundle, flat G bundles on C. So what's a flat bundle? Flat bundle is a pair, which is a principal bundle E and a flat connection. Now, when I say G bundles, I really treat C as a complex algebraic variety. And so this is an algebraic G bundle, but you can also think of it as a holomorphic bundle. Holomorphic G bundle on C. So a flat G bundle then is a holomorphic G bundle on C, which I call E, straight E. I will just call it G bundle without adding the word holomorphic or algebraic. This will always be understood. And this is a flat connection. Well, it is automatically flat because as a complex algebraic variety, it's one-dimensional, so there is no flatness condition. But more specifically, say if you want to write it in coordinates, if you choose a local coordinate z, then and trivialize the bundle locally, then nabla is going to be, it's a 1-0 part of the connection, and the 0-1 part comes from the holomorphic structure on E. So it is dz plus a of z. So we have these two moduli, stacks, bund G and log G, bundles and flat bundles. And one more piece of data is that we have this duality, which I already mentioned at the very beginning. For each reductive complex algebraic Lie group, we have its Langlands dual. So, Langlands dual group. And this, I'm not going to repeat the definition. I'm sure that everyone here has heard this many times. But it's just the usual game of replacing, of choosing maximal torus, writing roots and co-roots and weights and co-weights, and then switching them, roots with co-roots and weights with co-weights, and thereby recovering the root data of another reductive algebraic group. Okay, so now the most advanced formulation of the geometric Langlands correspondence in the categorical form can be written like this, as an equivalence of categories not yet completely defined. One will be the category involving all modules on the moduli stack of LG bundles. So all modules means also can be thought of as coherent sheaves. So perhaps, if you prefer this terminology, or perhaps quasi-coherent. And on the other side, one should take a category of D modules on bund G. So D modules here, D refers to the sheaf of differential operators. Differential operators on bund G. And so it's generated by functions and vector fields. And so to have a D module is the same as to have an O module on which you can also add by vector fields, satisfying all the usual relations in the algebra of differential operators. For example, if you have a bundle with a connection, this is a D module because a vector bundle gives you this, I mean, the sheaf of sections of a vector bundle with connection is a D module because you can act by multiply sections by functions, but also you can differentiate sections by using the flat connection. Okay. So roughly the categorical geometric Langlands correspondence says that there should be an equivalence between certain categories which should be represented by these two boxes. And unfortunately, right now, we don't really have a precise mathematical definition of these two categories. One thing for sure is that we should not simply look at the abelian categories of these objects, or modules and D modules, but we should consider some sort of derived categories on both sides. So it should be derived categories where there's some condition, they should include some unbounded objects, but those objects should be severely controlled by some conditions which are not yet specified. And also, the definitions of this particular stack should perhaps be modified to allow certain sort of odd directions, or certain supersymmetric directions, if you will. But so for now, this is a label for something which you don't really know, or derived category of O modules on the stack of local systems or flat bundles, and derived category of D modules on Bungee. But it is expected that, if properly defined, these two categories should be equivalent to each other. And in fact, what gives us some confidence that this should be the case is that actually it is true those categories can be defined rigorously, and they are equivalent to each other. In the simplest case, when G is a billion. In other words, say G is GL1, or a more general torus, which can, of course, be reduced to the case of GL1. So in this case, this is something which is called a Fourier-Mukai transform, or enhanced Fourier-Mukai transform. And which in this form has been proved by Lamont and Rothstein. So in the abelian case, there are no technical issues, there are no serious technical issues involved. Indeed, there are these two categories are equivalent to each other. And we hope that in the non-abelian case, there are some proper definitions which would again give us two categories which are also equivalent to each other. And that's the categorical form of the Langlands correspondence. Now, there is more, in fact. There is more. This equivalences should also satisfy various rigidities, various properties. And one of these properties is that there is a family of functors acting on both sides, which should be intertwined by this equivalence, which let me write it as a categorical Langlands correspondence. So on this side, this is what we'll call the Wilson functors. And on this side, these are the Hecke functors. So here the functors are labeled, in both cases they are labeled by two parameters, say a point of the curve and a representation of the dual group on both sides. So this will be H, X, V. So here X is a point on the curve, and V is a representation of the dual group. So these are very easy to define, and they're closely related to the Wilson operators in quantum field theory, whereas these guys are more complicated, and they are actually closely related to the Hooft operators in four-dimensional Young Mills. So they're non-local in nature. And yet, under this duality, they should really correspond to each other. And there are more rigidities, which I'll talk about in a short while. Okay, so this is the categorical version. But what people usually call the geometric Langlands correspondence is not exactly like this. It's a little bit simpler. It's a kind of simplified version, which can be, if we knew that, could be obtained in the following way. So amongst the O modules, amongst the coherent sheaves, the simplest ones are the skyscraper sheaves. They are supported at points of this moduli space or moduli stack. So if E is a point, then we can look at the skyscraper sheaf. Skyscraper at E. And that's a well-defined O module or coherent sheaf. And so if we have an equivalence of categories, this simple object on the left-hand side should correspond to something on the right-hand side. And let's call this F sub E. So this is a certain D module on Bungee. And because of this property that this correspondence is supposed to intertwine two types of functors, this object should satisfy a very non-trivial property, which is called the Hecke eigenschief property. The point is that just by its very definition, this object is what one can call an eigenobject of the Wilson functors. What do I mean by this? So OE is an eigenschief of the Wilson functors. W- what it means is that if you apply one of these Wilson functors, you get back O of E, but you multiply it by a vector space, which underlies this representation V. So V is a representation of the dual group. So in particular, it means that it's a vector space endowed with an action of this group. So this vector space I will denote by V underlined. So what happens is that when you apply this Wilson functor to this skyscraper sheaf, you get it back tensored with a finite dimensional vector space underlying this representation. In other words, it's a direct sum of copies of this origin, of this object taken as many times as the dimension of this vector space. This is very clear from the definition of the Wilson functors, but I'll skip the definition of the Wilson functors since it's not the most important point right now. So, why a vector space? Well, when we talk about eigenvector is something on which you act by an operator and it gets multiplied by a number. But now we have elevated everything to the categorical level, which means that vectors get replaced by objects of a category, and numbers should be replaced by vector spaces. So it is very natural that the eigenvalue of this functor is not a number, but is a vector space. And one way to think about it is the following, that you may think that there is some operator acting here, and you can sort of go back from the categorical level back to the level of vector spaces and so on. And then this object will give rise to a vector in the K-theory, in the Grothendieck group of this category. And then this vector space will get replaced by the trace of this operator acting on this vector space. So there is, you should think that there is some operator acting, lurking in the background, and you can sort of recover back the number, the eigenvalue, by taking the trace. But the vector space is important. This formulation is a stronger formulation than just saying that the certain vector in the Grothendieck group is an eigenvector of this operator. This operator, in fact, shows up if you look at the case of a curve, not over the complex field, but over the finite field. In that case, it is what's called the Frobenius operator, or Frobenius conjugacy class associated to this point. I'll get to this in a second. But for now, I just want to emphasize the following simple fact, that if we accept that the object on the left-hand side, the skyscraper sheaf, is an eigensheaf of this Wilson operator, something that can be verified almost trivially, then we have to that the object on the right-hand side should also satisfy a similar property with respect to the Hecke functors. Namely, if you apply the Hecke functor associated to the same X and V, then we should get it back tensored with this vector space. And this is already a very non-trivial property. Very non-trivial property, which tells us that F sub E is what's called Hecke eigenschaft. Usually, in the formulation of the geometric Langlands correspondence, people start with this sort of pointwise statement, which is that for every local system or every flat bundle E, like so, a bundle with a connection, there should exist a D module on bond G, which is a Hecke eigensheaf with respect to E. Now, in the formulation which I have just given, we don't see the flat bundle in this Hecke correspondence. But that's because I have fixed a point on the curve. So here is my curve. Here's my curve, and here's a point. And for each point x, I have an operator, a functor, and such that when I apply it to my sheaf, to my D module, I get it back tensored with a vector space. But now, if I vary, the statement is that as I vary this point, this vector space should combine into a flat bundle, and that flat bundle should be nothing but the original flat bundle E. More precisely, the original flat bundle E taken in representation V, which is a representation of the dual group. So as we vary the point, vary x, get E times over LGV, flat vector bundle. Flat vector bundle of these multipliers. I would like to call them eigenvalues, but I don't want to confuse things, so let's just call them multiplier, multiplying vector spaces. So these multiplying vector spaces, which occur at each point, actually combine into a flat vector bundle. And that flat vector bundle should be, for given E, just the flat vector bundle associated to this flat LG bundle and representation V. So we will say that this is a Heike eigensheaf corresponding to E for E. Okay? In other words, once you construct this, you actually recover E by if indeed it is a Heike eigensheaf, the flat vector bundle can be recovered just when you look at these multipliers and allow the point to vary. And so in this sense, it sets up a correspondence between points of the of this moduli stack, which are flat LG bundles, and Heike eigensheaves. But this formulation is not very symmetrical, because on one side you have points of a moduli stack, and on the other side you have D-modules, objects of a category. So that's why this categorical Langlands correspondence has the advantage of being more symmetrical. You have categories on both sides, and if you want to recover the standard formulation, you simply restrict yourself to some very simple basic objects on the left-hand side, the skyscraper sheaves. So let's take this as a starting point for the Langlands correspondence. Oh, and by the way, perhaps I should say that how is this, just a small aside, how is this related to the usual to Langlands correspondence, to the usual to the Langlands program as it was originally formulated? The point is that suppose that we study study curves not over complex number like here, but over the finite over a finite field, over a finite field. So in this case, E, which actually could be thought of this flat bundle, actually gives rise to a homomorphism from pi 1 of C with respect to some point, say, called P, to LG. And likewise, when you are over a finite field, this gets replaced by what's called a Tal fundamental group, and eventually by the Galois group of the field of functions. So if you take the field of rational functions on C, and take its algebraic closure and a group of automorphisms, it is like the fundamental group. And so the role of this parameter flat bundle is played in this context by a homomorphism from the Galois group to LG. In the categorical Langlands, in the pointwise correspondence, this E should correspond to F sub E, this Heike eigensheaf. In the classical state, in classical Langlands correspondence, the role of this Heike eigensheaf is played by Heike eigenfunction, or more generally by what's called an automorphic representation. Automorphic representation. Of the group over the ring of so-called adels. I don't want to get too much into details, but this is roughly the dictionary between the geometric language and the classical language. The Galois, the fundamental group gets replaced by Galois representation, or the flat bundle gets replaced by Galois representation. The Heike eigensheaf gets replaced by an automorphic representation. And so we should have a correspondence like this. And the fact that this categorical correspondence intertwines these functors, which results in the statement that this is actually a Heike eigensheaf, allows us to learn something about this Galois representation from the study of harmonic analysis associated with this automorphic representation, which is the reason why people are so excited about the Langlands correspondence. It gives you number theory confirmation from the study of representations. Okay, so this is all mathematical introduction. And so now, how to relate this to four-dimensional Young Mills? This was explained about 4 years ago by Kapustin and Witten. They start with a four-dimensional super young Mills theory, more precisely, n equal 4 supersymmetric young Mills. By the way, are there any questions about what I have? Wilson functors should behave linearly. Right, right, yes. In other words, if you apply it to direct sum, you will get the direct sum, yes. For both Wilson and Heike. Any other questions? Okay. So now we get to the physics part. And so here, Kapustin-Witten start with a four-dimensional n equal 4 supersymmetric young Mills or gauge theory. So what are the parameters of this theory? Well, first of all, there is a gauge group, which should be a compact Lie group, and I will call it G sub C. C indicating compact. It's a small c, had nothing to do with this, which is a big C. Okay? So this is a compact Lie group. This is a gauge group. And there is also a complexified coupling constant. Combines usual coupling and so-called theta angle. And so now we look at, so roughly speaking, the S-duality of this theories is the following, that we look at the two gauge theories which have as gauge groups the compact Lie group GC and its Langlands dual, which is also the compact form of the complex group LG. And for this one, we take the coupling constant tau, and for this one, we take the coupling constant minus 1 over tau. And conjecturally, these two theories should be equivalent to each other. And that statement is referred to as the S-duality. Something discovered by Montonen and Olive in the 70s, and also Goddard, Knights, and Olive, the work in which this group was introduced in this context. So of course, needless to say that if this statement is correct, it has very far-reaching consequences because it relates the theory. For example, if you take, say, theta is 0, you see that this transformation tau going to negative 1 over tau exchanges G and G inverse, G and G inverse. So that means that it gives you a way to get information about strongly coupled system, strongly coupled theory with a very large value of the coupling constant in terms of the theory at weak coupling at G, which is very small. So this is a very strong statement. And of course, this explains the reason why people are so interested in this, in S-duality. And now, just like in the mathematical context of Langlands correspondence, this is fairly well understood in the abelian case. So just like I said, here, this is actually a theorem in the abelian case. And this S-duality is also a theorem, as much as it could be called a theorem in the physics sense, when G is an abelian Lie group, for example, U1. But the challenge is to really understand what happens when the gauge group becomes non-abelian. And you see again that this is a very interesting phenomenon of replacing the compact group by its Langlands dual, something which actually oftentimes drastically changes the structure of the group. For example, the symplectic group gets replaced by odd orthogonal groups, so groups which at first glance have nothing to do with each other. And yet the corresponding quantum field theories turn out to be equivalent under this replacement of the coupling constant. Okay, so So this is sort of a rough statement. So the more precise statement is the following. So to relate this duality to the geometric Langlands correspondence, Kapustin and Witten actually consider a certain twist, which they call GL twist, which I understand stands for geometric Langlands, GL twist of this theory. And then this twist actually has two different BRST operators, two operators, so square to one. And then they look at the topological quantum field theory associated to a linear combination of these two operators. So in other words, they have a supercharge, which is, say, UQL plus VQR, QL and QR being two independent supercharges after this twist, which square to zero and also anti-commute with each other. So the Q squared is one, is zero, and you can study the topological sector of the theory, which is to say that you look at observables and other objects like boundary conditions, which are preserved by this operator or annihilated by this operator. And then you only look at the sector which consists of such operators or boundary conditions, etc. And so that means that in addition to tau, you actually have one more parameter, which is the parameter of the supercharge, which, of course, what matters is just the ratio between them. So we'll call T V over U, say. And so it turns out then that under S duality, T actually goes to, so maybe I go to go this way. T goes to LT, which is tau divided by absolute value of tau. And so to relate to the geometric Langlands, Kapustin and Witten take very specific values of the parameters. So namely, they take tau, let's write it again. So tau will be equal to zero, and T will be equal to one. And then here will be the dual group. And of course, under this transformation, L tau will be equal to infinity, and LT will be equal to I. I hope I didn't. Actually, right. So, so it's a very, actually, we're talking about a very specific point in the moduli space of this type of theories. And then what they do is that they consider a two-dimensional compactification of this four-dimensional theory. In other words, they look at the special case when the four-dimensional manifold on which we study this theory, of course, that should also be thought of as a parameter of the theory, not just the gauge group and the coupling constant, but also the actual manifold M4, four-dimensional manifold. So they look at the case when M4 is a product of two Riemann surfaces, sigma and C. So now finally sigma shows up, and C is like before. And sigma actually may be a Riemann surface with a boundary, because we will actually be interested in boundary conditions in this theory. And so then we compactify the theory on C. So the result is an effective theory, yet a supersymmetric theory, an effective theory on sigma. And of course, the first question is, what is this? What is this theory? And this question has essentially been answered in the mid-90s by two groups. The answer is that this is actually a supersymmetric sigma model. So the two groups are Harvey Moore and Stroninger, and also Bershadsky, Sadov, and Waffa, if I remember correctly. So the answer is that this is n equal to 2 twisted again, where the twist depends on the choice of the twisting that we have taken to begin with, a sigma model. on sigma, so the source is sigma, but the target knows about C, and the target is what's called, what's denoted MH of G, C, which I will also denote oftentimes MH of G, is a Hitchin moduli space. Moduli space of Higgs G models. So the S duality of this four-dimensional Young-Mills theory then in this upon compactification on C gives rise to an equivalence of two-dimensional quantum field theories. Perhaps actually I should keep this for future reference. And I will write here. Two-dimensional theories, and those are the sigma models with a target and the target is the Hitchin moduli space. So one theory has a target, the theory on the left will have as a target MH of LG, and the theory on the right will have the target MH of G. Now, I recall that the Higgs field is a pair E and phi, or G Higgs field, where E is a G bundle, again, a principal G bundle, on C, and phi is a one-form with values in the adjoint bundle. So it is a section of GE tensor KC. This is a canonical line bundle of one-forms, holomorphic one-forms, and G sub E is, of course, just the associated vector bundle to E and the adjoint representation. So we have sigma models associated with these two target manifolds, and they should be equivalent to each other. So in fact, I have to be a little bit more precise because we're talking about twisted sigma models. So I have to say more precisely what are the twistings. And so on the left-hand side, this is actually what's called a B model, so B twist. And the B model depends on a complex structure. The interesting aspect here is that this is actually a hyperKeller manifold. Both of them are hyperKeller manifolds. So they have three basic complex structures denoted by I, J, and K. And here there is we're referring to a B model with respect to a specific complex structure in which actually it can be interpreted as a moduli space, but not as a moduli space of Higgs fields. Rather, it is the complex structure, so-called complex structure J, in which it appears as the moduli space of flat bundles. The moduli of Higgs bundles turns out to be isomorphic as a real manifold to the moduli space of flat LG bundles. When I say moduli space as opposed to moduli stack, I'm actually imposing some stability condition and referring to the corresponding moduli of stable bundles or semi-stable bundles, and likewise moduli of stable or semi-stable flat LG bundles. So it's a slightly smaller, redefined piece of the moduli stack, of the corresponding moduli stacks. So this is a B model with the target being the moduli space of flat LG bundles. Now on this side we're talking about the A model. That's a twist which corresponds to the twist chosen by Kapustin-Wetten. And in the A model, what matters is a symplectic structure. And here, the symplectic structure we take is the one which is called omega k, symplectic structure, with respect to which this is almost like the cotangent bundle to bungee. Almost, again, because of the fact that bungee was defined as a moduli stack, and this is defined as a moduli of semi-stable Higgs bundles. So it's sort of birationally, if you will, birationally equivalent. Okay. And so now, what's the connection to the categorical Langlands correspondence? Well, the idea is that because we have this mirror symmetry. So I have to say that S-duality gives rise to an equivalence of this of this sigma models. And in fact, it was already shown in those works in the mid-90s that I mentioned earlier that this equivalence is in fact an instance of mirror symmetry. And in fact, it's a very special flavor of mirror symmetry, which is called the SYZ, Strominger, Yao, Zaslow framework for mirror symmetry, where in fact it's a sort of a fiber, it's generically fiber-wise T-duality. More precisely, what it means is that each of these moduli spaces fibers over one and the same vector space, which I'll call B. This is called a Hitchin base, where generic fibers are tori. Generic fibers are tori. And the two fibers over a given point in the base, let's call them LFB and FB, they're actually dual tori. There's dual tori, which can be taken as saying that this is a moduli space of flat unitary line bundles on this torus, for example. So generically, this mirror symmetry is just the T-duality of this tori. But of course, the devil, so to speak, is in a singular fibers, because these families of tori degenerate very wildly at various points, and so the sort of the non-triviality of this non-abelian mirror symmetry, as opposed to the abelian mirror symmetry or T-duality of these generic fibers, is in some sense contained in those singular fibers. Okay, so now what Kapustin-Witten suggests we do is we should consider the categories of brains in these two sigma models. And of course, because this is a B model, we should look at the category of B brains. And because this is an A model, we should look here at the category of A brains. Because these two theories are equivalent under mirror symmetry, the two categories of brains should also be equivalent. And so what it means is that there should be an equivalence of these two categories called the category of B brains on MH, which actually, more precisely, on this Y of LG, which is really this. I would like to emphasize that this is, with respect to the complex structure J, this is really the moduli space of flat bundles, as opposed to Higgs fields. That's what this notation Y of LG stands for. And on the other side, we have the category of A brains on MH of G. And the mirror symmetry, or perhaps we should call it homological mirror symmetry, because Kantsevich introduced this type of equivalences in the mid-90s under the name of homological mirror symmetry. So I'll write it as HMS, homological mirror symmetry. This should be an equivalence of these categories. Now, what are these categories? So the category of B brains is more easily understood mathematically and essentially should be the category, apart from various technical points, it should be the derived category of coherent sheaves on this moduli space, or anyway, the derived category of all modules. So it is almost equal to this, apart from the fact that this is a moduli stack, and this is a moduli space of semi-stable ones, which, of course, at this level of precision, we might as well ignore. So it is essentially one and the same, because to say a B brain is like to say an O module. On the other hand, this category is much more sophisticated. This is a category which includes, in particular, objects of what's called the Fukaya category. In other words, typical objects here are pairs, a Lagrangian submanifold, and a flat unitary connection on it. Lagrangian. In MH of G, and this is a flat unitary vector bundle on it. But in fact, it includes more. It also includes pairs where the first object is not Lagrangian but coisotropic, and the connection, which is not necessarily flat. So here, then, here is how Kapustin-Witten suggests that we should link the geometric Langlands correspondence and this homological mirror symmetry, which can be traced all the way back to astuality of four-dimensional super-Young Mills. They suggest that there should, in fact, be also an equivalent of these categories, which has nothing to do with either homological mirror symmetry or categorical Langlands correspondence, and is due to the fact that essentially this moduli, again, if we forget about the issue of stability and the fact that here is a moduli stack and here's a moduli space, this is essentially the cotangent bundle to bund G. So they suggest that, in fact, there should always be a connection between the category of D modules on some, say, variety Z and the category of A brains on its cotangent bundle. And this is an instance of that. They give a sort of physics explanation of this. And since that time, in fact, we have more, this has been refined and put on more on a firmer ground by mathematicians, in particular by Nadler and Zaslow-Nadler, giving really much mathematical formulation of this kind of equivalence. So I'll call this roughly microlocalization, even though microlocalization normally refers to something else, but it's a kind of a deformation of microlocalization in some sense. Microlocalization. I just want some term to distinguish it from everything else. Microlocalization. And so then there you have it. There should really be a triangle of categories. We can, in some sense, think that this is one and the same category. And under the geometric Langlands correspondence, it is equivalent to the D modules on bund G. And under mirror symmetry or S-duality, it is equivalent to the category of A brains. And microlocalization is what fills this triangle into an equivalence, into this triple equivalence. So that's a rough summary of the work of Kapustin-Witten. Now, and this is really one can ask what can we gain from this? In other words, we had one mysterious equivalence, and now we have two more mysterious equivalences, which are kind of which we write into a triangle. But of course, they are mysterious, but each of them maybe has some nice aspects, and by learning from, we can learn from those aspects for one of them to say something about another. And so one of the wonderful aspects of this is that, in fact, we can ask what happens for the simplest objects on the left-hand side, which I recall were these skyscraper sheaves corresponding to a particular flat LG bundle. And then in this category, it should be this mysterious object F sub E, this Hecke-Eigen sheaf. And in some sense, nobody has ever seen this Hecke-Eigen sheaf. I mean, to say, well, maybe one can describe it, but it's very difficult to actually give a good example in the non-abelian case. In abelian case, it's very simple, but in non-abelian case, these objects are notoriously complicated. So it's sort of an embarrassment, in some sense, for the geometric Langlands correspondence that we don't really have any non-trivial examples which we could work out explicitly. On the other hand, but now that we have a triangle of equivalences, we can ask, what do we get in this category, in this third category, which comes from directly from physics? And it turns out that even though this category is not completely defined as of yet, but we know that we know a bunch of a large class of objects in this category. For instance, like I said, smooth Lagrangian submanifolds equipped with a flat unitary vector bundle. And so we can ask as to whether we can predict what is the A brain corresponding to the skyscraper sheaf, or what a physicist would call a zero brain, a zero B brain on the left-hand side. So let me call this A sub E, A for A brain. And it turns out, and this is what Kapustin and Witten show, turns out that actually this is a very nice object, unlike this one. And in fact, what it is the L here would be the fiber over the point in the base, which is the image of this E. So we have this point in here. And we will assume that this is a generic point. It's a smooth point. So then actually take its image in here, B, and take the fiber of the dual vibration. It is a Lagrangian submanifold. Moreover, each, as I said, these two tori are dual. So each point in this fiber gives you a flat unitary line bundle on this one. And so that's exactly what the A brain dual of that zero brain, O sub E, should be. It should be this fiber, FB, with a connection which is determined by E, because E is the point of the dual fiber, which is to say it gives rise to a flat unitary connection on this fiber. So this is a much nicer object than this one. And so, of course, this is the first indication that for understanding questions about geometric line length correspondence, this equivalence might be very useful. Okay? So now, what can we do? So what should we do next? Well, it's a beautiful picture, but it only covers, in some sense, a generic situation. Because the point is that in order to describe, when we say that the effective theory on sigma, which is obtained by compactifying these four-dimensional Young Mills on C, is in fact this two-dimensional sigma model with this target manifold. This is only an approximation, and this is only valid sort of in the neighborhood of a generic point. A generic point would be a bundle without any infinitesimal automorphisms. But of course, we know that in real life we have automorphisms, and we have them in gauge theory, and we also have them in the two-dimensional setting. We can have flat bundles, flat LG bundles on a Riemann surface, which have infinitesimal automorphisms. And in some sense, these are the most complicated ones, the most difficult ones. As I said, the devil is somehow in the singular fibers, and that's where those bundles will be found, in those singular fibers. So then there is a big question as to what happens for these more general flat bundles, for example, for these more general singular fibers. So as a first step in this direction, Witten and I studied the question when the group of automorphisms of the flat bundle is not continuous, but it's finite. So it's sort of a case of orbifold points of this moduli space. And we looked to see if we can understand this orbifold structure of B brains or coherent sheaves on the left-hand side in some geometric terms on the right-hand side. And in fact, we did see in very explicit examples and then conjecture in general that this appearance of finite groups of automorphisms on this side is reflected in the fact that these fibers become reducible. And in some sense, the number of the components are labeled by elements of the group, which is a group of automorphisms of this flat vector, of this flat LG bundle. So orbifolds, the situation of orbifolds was studied by Witten and myself. And next came the question of more general flat bundles. And here, very important results were obtained by Gaiota and Witten, who have shown that there are some hidden ingredients also in this effective theories. There is an additional scalar field which you call sigma, which is identically equal to zero in the neighborhood of a smooth point of the moduli space, but becomes very essential when we allow automorphisms. And they have given lots of examples of what happens, what S-duality does when we do include this additional field sigma. And so they have found some very interesting effects, and some of them actually seem to have important counterparts in geometric line length correspondence. For example, the appearance of the so-called Arthur-Essel II, Unfortunately, I don't have much time to talk about this. I just want to indicate this area, which is very interesting in my view. And in fact, we had Gaiotto give a series of talks on this in the last conference in this series in March of last year. So there is this very important work, and actually Sergei Gukov and I have an ongoing project on this topic, and obtained some results. And also Witten wrote a paper about a year ago in which he discusses this applications of his work with Gaiotto to this picture. So I want to use now the remaining time to talk a little bit about the two-dimensional connection to the other physics, to the two-dimensional physics, to two-dimensional conformal field theories, and then I will not talk too much about this because Sergei will take over in the afternoon, but I want to say a few words what this is, how this shows up from a mathematical point of view. He will talk more about the physics aspects of that correspondence. So this is a beautiful picture relating this sort of triangle of categories. It's a beautiful picture relating categorical Langlands correspondence and S-duality in 4D, four-dimensional Young Mills, or mirror symmetry of two-dimensional sigmoid models. But also there is a connection to the two-dimensional conformal field theories. And this is when I talk about this, what I mean is that there is a construction of this sheaves F sub E, of this correspondence E going to F sub E, using methods of conformal field theories. After all, what we are looking for is a D module on the moduli space of G bundles. It should also have some very important property, which is the Heike eigenschaft property, right? But first and foremost, it is a D module on bond G. By the way, to really make this picture complete, I should also mention that there is a series of functors in this category as well, which commutes with the other functors under these equivalences. And these are the so-called, what Kapustin-Witten called the Tjoft functors. They in fact come from the Tjoft operators of the four-dimensional Young Mills. And moreover, they have actually checked in some instances that this A-brain, this generic A-brain, which I described, the fiber, the Hitchin fiber with a particular flat unitary line bundle, is indeed an eigenobject of this Tjoft operators or Tjoft functors. Okay, let's go back to the two-dimensional setting. So we need to construct a D-module on bond G. And what is a D-module? A prototype for a D-module is a bundle, a vector bundle with a connection. Now, conformal field theory gives us a way to construct such objects from conformal blocks. Usually, we talk about conformal blocks as giving rise to bundles with a flat connection, not on the moduli space of G bundles, which this is. This is a moduli of G bundles on C, but rather on the moduli of complex structures on C. So in CFT, it's been understood for many years, since the mid-80s, particularly the work of Friedan and Schenker and others, that spaces of conformal blocks, at least in the simplest models of conformal field theories, such as minimal models or more general rational conformal field theories, they actually combine into a flat vector bundle. Flat vector bundle on MGN, the moduli of Riemann surfaces of genus G with n marked points. Well, n would correspond to the number of insertions, number of operators in this conformal block. So they combine into vector bundle, which is kind of easy to see. But what's less trivial is the fact that actually there is a flat connection. This flat connection is due to the fact that the moduli spaces MGN are uniformized by the Virasoro algebra. So in some sense, this moduli space is a double quotient of the Virasoro algebra. And that's what gives you a way to not only multiply sections by functions, but also differentiate sections. The reason why the, in general, CFT conformal blocks give rise to flat vector bundles on MGN is, of course, the Virasoro symmetry. This is due to Virasoro symmetry. So you have a holomorphic stress tensor. But there is also, there is a generalization of this where we also consider models with Katz-Moody symmetry. So instead of Virasoro algebra, we have the affine Katz-Moody algebra, or perhaps a semi-direct product of the Virasoro and affine Katz-Moody algebra. Just like Virasoro algebra uniformizes the moduli space of Riemann surfaces, or moduli space of complex structures on a given Riemann surface, the affine Katz-Moody algebra uniformizes bund G, this moduli of G bundles. So G hat affine Katz-Moody algebra uniformizes bund G. And so if you have a theory with affine Katz-Moody algebra, so in, I'll call it GCFT, conformal field theory with a Katz-Moody symmetry, then the space of conformal blocks give you, in a rational conformal field theory, say, for example, a Bezumin-Witten model at some positive integral level. So this gives you more, a flat bundle, flat vector bundle on bund G. And this should be a prototype, in fact, for a relationship between conformal field theories with Katz-Moody symmetry and D modules. For rational conformal field theories like Bezumin-Witten model, in fact, what you get, what you can possibly get, is just a flat vector bundle because the spaces of conformal blocks are finite dimensional. So you get a D module where all fibers are finite dimensional is going to be a flat vector bundle. But we can look at more exotic models where, I mean, not only they are finite dimensional, but also they are they have the same dimension. I mean, of course, fibers could be finite dimensional, but still be given non-trivial D module. But actually, they have all the same dimension. So it has to be a flat vector bundle. But we can look at more exotic theories with Katz-Moody symmetry. And the same machine of conformal field theory would give rise, would associate to such a model a bunch of D modules on bund G. And so the idea of this connection between geometric Langlands and two-dimensional conformal fields is to use this machine and apply it to a particular, very exotic from the physics point of view, class of field theories. And so what we have here to really get to the geometric Langlands is we have to look at affine, a theory with G-hat symmetry at a very special level, which is minus Dewey-Coxton number. At this level, actually, the Virasoro algebra ceases to exist. The formula, the Shugawara formula giving T of Z as a quadratic expression in terms of the currents of the Katz-Moody algebra breaks down precisely at this value of the level. So we shouldn't call it conformal field theory because we actually don't have conformal invariants. But it's a kind of a G-hat theory where we don't have Virasoro, but we do have affine Katz-Moody. So we might as well apply this machine and produce a D-module, or actually a bunch of D-modules depending on which representations we insert at various points, on bund G. And so the representation theory at the critical level was studied by Fagin and myself, and then Bellinson and Drinfeld have shown that actually the D module that you get in this way is a sort after Hecke-Eigen sheaf. at least in a special case, when at least for some special class of flat bundles, the so-called OPER. So there we have it. The connection to 2D is done by means of a very degenerate conformal field theory, which actually is no longer conformally invariant, but has Katz-Mulli algebra symmetry. And by using the conformal blocks, well, you can still use the word conformal blocks, even though the theory is not conformal. Conformal blocks give rise to this D module, and this D module solves the geometric Langlands correspondence, at least pointwise. So the question now is, that's where we were sort of, let's say, 5 years ago when we knew this connection to 2D conformal field theory, and we understood, due to the work of Kapustin and Witten, we understood in the language of brains the connection between the categorical formulation of Langlands and mirror symmetry or S-duality. And the question was, how do you relate this two different approaches, right? There've got to be some connection. So that's the triangle. That's the triangle which I have drawn at the very beginning. Now that we have connected geometric Langlands to 4D physics, more specifically, supersymmetric Young-Mills theory, and we have connected, even though there are still many points we don't understand, but we do see a connection, as in particular shown by this equivalences, triangle of equivalences. Well, it looks like quadrangle, but it really is triangle because these two are the same. Now that we have understood, we have seen also connection to 2D conformal field theories, it's as natural to ask, what's the link between these two? And as I said, this is the area in which we've had a lot of progress in the last year or so, and this is what we would like to talk about in this coming 3 weeks. But basically, the idea is to shake this correspondences that we have discussed. For example, here, I talked about this Bellinson-Driffield construction, which gives you the Hecke eigenschief, but from a very degenerate conformal field theory at the critical level, k equals minus dual Coxeter number. So it's natural to ask what will happen if you deform away from the critical level. And it turns out that this, from the point of view of categorical equivalence, there is actually a deformation, which would involve twisted D modules on bond G and the bond LG, so to speak. I'm running out of time, so I will not write it, but we'll talk more about this in lectures and otherwise. So the idea is to deform everything, so to speak, deform the parameters. So we can deform the parameters in the geometric Langlands and consider what's called sometimes quantum geometric Langlands, where you have not the critical level, but you go away from the critical level, and this way you get a deformation of this equivalence. And then you can ask what happens with the corresponding equivalence also in four-dimensional Young-Mills. To get this particular equivalence from four-dimensional Young-Mills, as I already explained, Kapustin and Witten chose very specific parameters on both sides. They have fixed the coupling constant essentially, and they have fixed the twisting parameter. But now we have more. We can try to deform them, and actually there is a way, as was shown by Kapustin and Witten, and then a different way by Kapustin alone. There is a way to reproduce this deformation that I was talking about at sort of mathematical level, in terms of categories of brains. So this is one way of deforming. This is what I mean by deforming in general. But also, this leads us to more general class of two-dimensional conformal field theories, such as Liouville, and such as Wessel-Minnowitt models, and generalizations of Wessel-Minnowitt models with more general levels, maybe with non-compact Lie groups, and things like that. And here, we should also look at various deformations of this n equal 4 super Young-Mills, such as can give masses to various multiplets, consider more general n equal 2 supersymmetric theories. And along this path, in fact, we do see now, due to the work of Aldai, Gaiuto, and Tachikawa, and others, a link, also another line of work by Nekrasov and Shatashvili, which also relate four-dimensional Young Mills to algebraically completely integrable systems such as the Hitchin system, closely, which of course plays a very prominent role in this picture. So now we have quite a few results already about this link, and so there is hope that we will be able to understand more and more about this whole area. And so I hope that in the next 3 weeks we will really learn something in this direction. So I stop here. Thank you. All questions have been answered. So next talk will be by Sergei Gukov, who will talk more about the physics of this connection between 4D and 2D and give us a preview of the upcoming talks this week and next week on this subject. That will be at 2 o'clock, I believe.